history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be told if we'll take the time to ask a few questions and listen to those answers. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And the story that you're going to hear today is one that couldn't be told for decades. And you hear a lot of veterans who say they couldn't talk about it for decades, but those were personal reasons. This was a legal reason. He would have been in big trouble if he told this story before about a decade ago. We are in Hollister, California, a place that John Cardinale has called home for about 60 years now. But you grew up in Monterey, California, just a few miles away from here on the Central California coast. One of 12 children, a family. Your mother and father are both immigrants from Sicily. So what kind of childhood was that?
That was pretty rough in Sicily. There were children. And they weren't married there. They got married here in the United States where they met. Met in Pittsburgh, California, and they were married and raised a family.
And they kept it even. Six boys, six girls. You are the fourth from the bottom in that group of 12. Can you help me understand what that childhood was like around Monterey? I mean, we've read John Steinbeck stuff. We've heard about, you know, the canneries and all that. Is that the kind of atmosphere you grew up in?
Yes, that was pretty rough those days. We weren't the only family. In fact, all the Italian fishermen, they lived up at what they call Spaghetti Hill, the whole Italian district. All fishermen, they had a rough life, and we had the same thing, rough life. We're very poor. They're all poor. We slept five in a bed at that time, and the houses weren't like today. A boy or a girl had their own rooms, their own bathroom. We had to share one bathroom, and we slept three in the head and two in the feet, and we had a hell of a time.
How young were you when you had to start working and helping out the family in that fashion?
I started selling papers, I think, 10, 11 years old. And I started delivering, and I worked like hell, believe me, as a child. I never took any sports to school because I didn't have time to play. I worked, and every penny I made, it went to the family, helped support them, feed the family. And it was rough those days. We had passed clothes on from one kid to the other, and even went to school with holes in our shoes, and we had to get a piece of cardboard or playing card and place it in the shoulder so water or gravel wouldn't get in our feet. Like I said, we weren't the only family. There's hundreds of Italian people like that, kids. And we go around in the mornings, you get up, night you went to school, go around the play yard and say, "What are you carrying today, John?" "I have ace of spades in my soul." "And what do you got?" "I got the king of clubs," things like that. That was those days. Sure. Today I think about it, I die laughing. Anyway, it was rough, but we're happy.
Yeah, you write about that in your book. So many kids had those playing cards covering holes in the soles of their shoes that you guys could actually have a little card game. Hard for a lot of people today to fathom that. And at home with your parents and those 11 siblings, were you guys speaking English or Italian?
We had to speak Italian. My mother and father could speak English, but not to our kids. My brother and sister all English speaking. You know? And we got along fine, no arguments.
I've got to ask, only because I married into an Italian family and I know how priceless some of those recipes are. Was there a dish that your mother made that you can think about right now and still taste it in your memory?
Let's see, my mother's a great cook. Well, she'd make raviolis twice a year in Easter and Christmas time, but she was a great cook altogether. Chupinos and fish chupino, meat chupino, and stews, whatever. Pizza. Those days, the pizza they called the shawada. I don't know if any Italian people would know the name shawada. Means two layers of pizza, one on top of each other. The layer of dough, and you grate it. Those days, we had anchovies, lots of anchovies. No, we couldn't afford the pepperoni, all that. So we had anchovies. Then another slice of pizza, bread on top of that, and you burn it and put it in your mouth. So high. You know? Anyway, but she was a great cook. Let's see, she baked 12 loaves of bread every other day. We ate 6 loaves a day, and that poor woman was always baking.
I know it's a long time ago. I mean, you're 96 years old now. We're going way back. But when you were a boy, do you remember having hopes or dreams or ambitions of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do. These are the adventures I'm going to have. This is the career I'm going to have.
I remember well when I was, I believe, 10, 12 years old. Now, this is kids talk, 10 years old, 12 years old. I told my mother in a town that whenever I get rich or become a rich man, I'm going to buy myself 100 pairs of shoes, 100 pairs of slacks. Now, this is kids talk now, 9, 10 years old, and 100 pairs of shirts, and I'm going to buy you a house. Well, as years went by, naturally grew up and got married and became pretty successful, I did buy her house. In fact, it's still there. Today, I still have 100 pairs of shoes, 100 pairs of slacks. I gave most away because I'm 96. They don't fit me anymore. But anyway, my dream came true, believe it or not. And I live well. I live in Ridgemar Country Club. I'm doing well. And
none of those 100 pairs of shoes have an ace of spades in the sole?
Nothing. These are all brand. I have to laugh. No more ace of spades. The only time I use an ace of spades when I play poker, you know. Uh-huh. The only time I see cards, but outside of that, that was a riot. All the kids had holes in their shoes. Everybody. A school kid, 10, 12, 11 years old. The way of life those days, nobody had any money. Well, most of all. I say 99% of those kids my age are all dead. I think I'm one of the last. And I'm one of the few of the last OSS member too, I believe. What I understand.
Well, I think that's right. And we're going to hear that story, and people can read about it in your book, 65 Years of Secrecy, a personal story of an OSS agent during World War II. Some people today don't even know what the OSS was, and you didn't either before World War II. Did you have any sense that war was coming? I mean, you're living here in Monterey, California. There's the big Presidio there. This is a big army spot. But did you have any inkling that something like this was going to happen?
I have no idea war was coming. It was a sudden attack, a surprise attack by Japan, the United States, and I had no idea. It just came out of nowhere.
Do you remember how you heard about it?
I don't remember how I heard. We heard it through the grapevine or through newspaper, radio, whatever, being attacked and so on and so forth.
Do you remember a sense of panic or fear around Monterey? I mean, that's a coastal spot. Could Japan attack right there?
Well, we were surprised. The reason I say that because there are a lot of Japanese members in Monterey that had fish markets, abalone boats. They used to dive for abalone. The only abalone boats were run by Japanese fishermen, and we know the Japanese real well, close family, close community. When it broke out, they found this one abalone boat drifting at sea. I guess they thought they sunk it, but I guess it was floating somehow, and the fuel was out of it. Now, this is according to the Coast Guard. And we found out it was one of the owners of Monterey Wharf Fish Market. He was a captain for the Japanese Navy, and he was gone. I guess somebody picked him up and took off, thinking the boat would sink, but evidently did not sink.
And I guess if you don't remember clearly December 7th and those days around there, there's a pretty good reason, because you were kind of smitten. You had this young lady, Josephine, that you were determined to marry so much that 5 days after Pearl Harbor, you guys went to Reno and eloped. Her dad couldn't have been happy about that.
Yeah, we eloped right after Pearl Harbor Day. Pearl Harbor the 7th, I eloped the 12th, I believe, of December. I wanted to wait till later on. I had a few dollars to get married, but I couldn't wait, I guess. And got my wife, we eloped, and she took off with the clothes in her back, and that's it. And I only had $300-$500 saved up, and we took off and used that, bought our clothes. I had rented a house before we left. Went to Pittsburgh, California. I had a friend that had a furniture store. I gave him $100 down. We ordered this, ordered that, and gave him the key to the house, and he had orders to deliver to Monterey, to Pacific Grove, and set the house up because we were taking off for a week for our honeymoon. And that was it. I got back from Pacific Grove. The house was all set up, and went back to fishing.
And so you were a commercial fisherman at the time, with quite a few of your brothers, too?
All my brothers are commercial fishermen, all of them, except one. We were six boys. One, he couldn't take the ocean. He'd vomit all over the place, so he couldn't go fishing. But five of us went fishing, and one was a partner, one of the purse seine, was called the City of Monterey. He's one of the partners there, and I fished for couple other boats, and the Bibini, and the Jackie Boy, and those are purse seine. They're 80-footers, pack around 140 ton of fish in the hatch. Sardines, I'm talking about. I went out fishing for quite a while. After sardines, about 1950, sardines disappeared from Monterey Bay and Pacific Coast, in fact. I quit fishing, went to work in town or whatever, started painting. From then on, painted about 6, 7 years, became a painting contractor, which I did well, and I moved around here and there, San Jose, and then I settled in Hollister, and I did pretty good in Hollister.
And for all those years, you had a lot of friends, and they all knew that you'd been a fisherman and a painter, but they didn't know much about what you did in World War II because you couldn't talk about it. But if you hadn't been drafted, you think you would have just kept on fishing? Did you have any eyes on the service at all?
I was drafted in 1942. They had put me in Presidio, Monterey. They gave me all kinds of aptitude tests, what I can do with a cavalry or whatever, radio, cook. Anyway, I excelled in radio, and they put me radio, and from there, I think I went to UC Davis for more radio experience and Morse code, that is. And from then on, I transferred to North Carolina, Camp Butner. I was infantry, still infantry, no SS yet, studied radio, and I was pretty good. I believe I was one of the best in the class of radio operators, and I kept moving up until I became a OSS operator.
And I want to hear the story of how that happened, but I'm just thinking about from a personal standpoint. Here you've got this big family you've been so close to for all these years. Now you've got a new wife.
She was pregnant. I was drafted, and we had a son just before when I went overseas. Before that, I was in infantry in North Carolina. I went on maneuvers, and I was an umpire, a radio operator for this lieutenant in charge and driver we had. So there were three in the vehicle. We went around umpiring this and that, went to Blue Army, Red Army. We can go any kitchen, want to eat, whatever, because we were neutral. We went to have supper, one of the fuel kitchens in North Carolina, the hill somewhere, I don't know where it was. That night, we had dysentery. 2 or 3 in the morning, I got up, my driver got up, and the officer got up, and they had a trench built from here to Kingdom Come. To all the squad, the trench. Anyway, me, the lieutenant in charge, and the driver got together and said, we're going to knock this team out. A fighting man can't fight if they had dysentery. And he went to the captain in charge of that battalion there, old major, I forgot what rank he had. We knocked him out. He couldn't fight anymore. Every Saturday, all these armies, blue and the red, got together, big, large tent, and a bunch of high-ranking officers as a judging. And our case came up, and the heads got together, and big wigs, they got together and told that we were right. And the captain was wrong. They're out of the maneuver, so we won our case. As we're leaving that tent, we're back to maneuvering again. I saw a big sign out there posted. I say the sign must be 3 by 3 feet or 4 by 4. Anyway, written chalk, and it says, wanted volunteers for OSS, Office of Strategic Services, hazardous duty, has to know radio, speak another language, and a couple other things that they want to know. Anyway, so I talked to my officer in charge. I said, I'm going to go sign up. I'm going to volunteer. He says, Cardinal, he says, you're crazy. You shouldn't volunteer. You know what you're getting into? I think I do. You're married. You got a child. Anyway, so I signed up. I signed up OSS, and we went back to maneuvering. Well, about 3 or 4 hours later, I get a call saying, return back to camp. And anyway, he said, pack your bag, Cardinal, and you're going to Washington, D.C. So whatever I had, and Mary Mother said, we'll get you all new clothing. So I packed whatever I had and went to the bus station and reported Washington, D.C. There was someone at the bus station waiting for me. Everything's all arranged, and they took me to a branch of the OSS, big warehouse. And anyway, I got in there and the warehouse, and with the driver that picked me up, told me to sit in this room, and the major be with you in a few minutes. He's interviewing someone else in another office. So I waited. As I was waiting, I'm sort of nosy guy, so I sat back and looked at the four walls and saw a big standing light there and the paperclip on the floor and his wife's picture and broken blinds and a few other things that I noticed. A picture of Roosevelt on the wall there. And after about 15, 20 minutes after I was alone, then he called me and he said, Colonel, come here. I'm ready to interview you. So I went to the next office where the major was. So he asked me, while you're sitting there waiting for him, what did you see? I told him about the lamp and the paper clip and the broken blade and the picture on the desk and cigarette and the ashtray. He said, you know, you're pretty good. You observed everything. I didn't expect that. I figured, what kind of questions are these, you know? And that was part of the test. He says, I didn't even notice a clip on the floor myself. He said, that was the major. He said, you should make a good OSS member. So from then on, I went to camp training as an OSS.
And had you ever heard of the OSS before you saw that sign?
I never heard of the OSS at all. Never heard anything about intelligence or nothing. But anyway, after that, from then on, I knew everything. In fact, I had to put my hand in the Bible, swear to whatever I hear here, the office, not to reveal it outside, or even your family. They stress it, even family. They didn't want anybody to know what we were doing. Because really, they said not family or anybody, because those days when the war was going on, we had thousands of German spies, saboteurs in Washington, D.C., all over the country in the United States. And we don't want our names to get around, being an OSS member, because they'd probably go after family and would either harm or wanted information or whatever, you know. But anyway, nothing more was said. So that's been secret for many, many years.
So you're not allowed to tell anyone, even family. What'd you tell your wife? What did she think you were doing?
She didn't know anything about it either. She thought I was in the Army. They all thought I was in the infantry there in North Carolina. But I never said a word, even my wife, for many years.
Many, many years. The title of his book is 65 Years of Secrecy. He's 96-year-old John Cardinale of Hollister, California. John was very pleased with the book design and layout that family friend Denise Baker produced for him. And if you'd like to have Mr. Cardinale sign one of those books for you or for a friend, he says you can even call him directly at area code 831-637-7397. I have that number and a link for online ordering for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll learn more about his top secret adventures when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.